Tom, you didn't get much sun during that parade.
I know. I should have made myself walk more. I'm a little tired. But fall is all of my speaking and traveling, and so this month kicked off with Homesteaders of America. And one of the people we traveled with to and from Homesteaders of America was sick. So the day after I got home from Homesteaders of America, I was sick. Now, sick for a number of days, I'm like, okay, got over this in a few days, took my elderberry, took my other things. And then a few days right after I got better, one of my kids came home, and they brought home a stomach bug from some family they had been playing with. So then I had a stomach bug. I'm like, okay, this is great. We had a stomach bug go through a family. Nothing will convince you of the truth of the fall like having a large family and having a stomach bug go through it. There's just nothing that will make you say this is, you know, the fall is real like a stomach bug with adults and children involved. So got over that. Like, yep, okay. And it was on Tuesday that my oldest son came down sick, that he picked up a cold from a group of friends he was with. So I got a cold on Thursday, which you can tell I'm still like a hair working off today. So I'm a little bit more tired than I usually feel, and I'm still down about 10 pounds from the stomach bug. So I'm feeling it's been a long month, which is one of the challenges of the modern world, especially if you have a lot of kids, is getting through cold and flu season. So this is going to be all practical for the next hour. I'm going to talk about practically how we as a family have sought to build a productive household in a number of different directions. You know, so we were talking about, you know, you earn money. You bring in dollar bills. And you need to decide what you're going to do with those. So I'm going to use a number of different examples of what we do. So the first thing I always tell people is the first thing we do with money in our household is we want to invest in building valuable skills. Because as I mentioned earlier, stuff is only useful if you have the skills to make use of it. So money we make, we're always looking at ourselves and our kids and saying, what skills can we acquire with this money that have appreciating value to our family economy and then in the broader economy? So skills are just a great thing to invest in. And there's so many different types of skills you can invest in. You know, if you run out to my gold van, I have on the floor in front of the passenger seat some medical kits, if you'll grab one of those. And the reason you want to invest in skills first is as you build skills, then you will know what, I'm going to have to like figure out how to write from the side, what stuff you actually need to go with these skills. So skills first, but as you become skillful, then you can acquire stuff. So a good example of this is like the ability to sharpen tools. How many of you sharpen your knives and other tools and stuff? Most people can't do that. So most people who want to start sharpening tools, do you know what they do? They first go buy a whole bunch of stuff, even though they have no idea how to use any of it. And 9 times out of 10, they end up having to yard sale or throw away a lot of the stuff they buy because it wasn't the right stuff for the skills they're trying to acquire. So when I wanted to learn knife sharpening and how to sharpen and maintain a bunch of my tools for my homestead, I called my friend Patrick Rohrer him, because he's a knife maker and a toolsmith. And I said, hey, the next time you are passing through Kentucky, will you spend a day with my family? And will you teach me how to maintain teach me and my children all how to maintain tools? So he was speaking at an event down in Tennessee. Him and a couple of his kids came up and stayed with us. And one whole day of our homeschool was knife and tool sharpening. And we began to go over not just the skills, so now we're learning the skills we need, but as we're all learning this skill, now I actually know what stuff I need to buy. He goes over, well, these are different type of whetstones, and these are holders, and there's this, and there's that. This is basic stuff you want to get. So in our family, we always invest primarily in skills over stuff. So when, you know, say you want to raise chickens, seems like almost all of you raise chickens. You know, once you've raised chickens for a while, you know, how many of you butcher your own chickens? Great. At that point, how many of you own a plucker? Yeah, you know, you really could have one plucker shared among all y'all. You know, but you see how that naturally the skill of raising chickens, once you reach a certain scale and a certain level of skillfulness and production, well, now buying these stuff, like a plucker, like a scalder, that becomes a smart move. But, or if you're like some of these homesteaders I know, they buy the plucker and the scalder first, and over half of them never acquire the skill of raising and butchering chickens, and then I buy it from them at 80% off, and I resell it at a profit because they were, you know, knuckleheads and did it this way. So we prioritize skills. Another example of this, people, you know, we live 40 minutes from the closest emergency care facility. Hopefully soon it'll only be 20 minutes. No, but one of the traditional responsibilities of a household, and this is something we see not just in that report. So that 1933 report, the duties it describes as being part of a household, I'm going to maybe talk about this in the next more teachy session. There is a book written by Xenophon, well-known Greek author, in 600 BC roughly, called the Oikionomos, the rule of the house. And one of the foundational responsibilities of the house, as described in this book 2,500 years ago, was medical care for the members of your household. That you primarily should be able to care for the people of your household and their medical needs. So, one of the first things I did straight out of seminary was begin to learn basic medical skills. I would take medical classes whenever I could. I would learn how to do basic injections and other stuff. You know, a bunch of us are homesteading. You are working with sharp knives and tools all the time. How many of you have had bad cuts? Do you know how to clean and debride and all of these other things to cut? And can you do basic stitching? It's one of the next things I really, really want to learn. I want to be able to do my own stitching for my kids and my grandkids. Because, man, what a pain is it to go to an emergent care facility to get three little stitches, to be asked about your vaccination status, to maybe have CPS called on you. We actually had this happen once. I was away speaking in Virginia, and my daughter stepped on something and cut her foot. And since I wasn't there to care for her, my wife ended up needing to take her to the emergency room. And at the emergency room, they noticed, like, well, she doesn't have a tetanus shot. I'm like, yes. I'm like, we're not drug users. We don't need these, you know. And so the lady's like, well, she should have a tetanus shot. She's like, we'll consider this, but we're here for you to look at the cut not inject our daughter full of pharmaceuticals. And the lady called CPS on us. So as much as possible, we've tried to acquire skills. And then when you acquire skills, all the crazy stuff in here, you'll know how to use. Because again, I know so many homesteaders or so many guys. This is true with firearms. I know so many guys who have like excessive collections of firearms. And they're stormtroopers. The safest place in the universe would be right in front of them pointing a gun at you. They ain't never going to hit you. So we try and invest a great deal in developing skills as a family, because some of these skills are going to be passed down to my kids' households. And you know, this is something to encourage you all. A lot of us are coming out of broken household intergenerational structures. And so our goal is to make things better for our kids. You know, like my primary skill by the time I got to high school was beating role-playing video games and watching Sunday morning cartoons. Most of my kids, by the time they were 12 to 15 years old, have as many skills as I had when I was 25. You know, like, my kids can all butcher animals. They all can do a whole bunch of basic medical care. They can all cook. They can make a whole bunch of stuff. They can use a whole bunch of tools and machinery I never could. So each of us just has to start where we are and chip away at this task that God has given us. So the other thing we want to do is money we acquire, we always want to dump into a productive asset. A productive asset in financial terms is the difference between working for money and making your money work for you. So, and productive assets can look like all sorts of things. My friend Jordan Green, he's a farmer in Virginia, and his productive asset is a 200-head beef herd. Because that he invested money in building this beef herd, and what does the beef herd do every year? It gives birth to more beef. And what has the cost of beef been doing year after year after year? It's going up. It's a productive asset. Productive assets can be rental properties. I think you've been thinking about getting into real estate stuff. There's hundreds of different types of productive assets. They can be investing in a small business that someone else in your church owns. So my friend Matthew Cook, he pastors Menard Fellowship, which is a church north of Knoxville, over on the other side of Tennessee. Just incredible guy, wonderful pastor. He actually was mayor of Menardville about like 13 or 14 years ago. So he started a real estate business as part of his church. He has used that real estate business to get almost every single family in his church now is completely debt-free through his real estate business. Imagine having a church of 40 families and not a single one has a mortgage payment. His church is, I think, three families away from that because he built this productive asset. But his real estate business also just produces a whole bunch of money. So there's another church just south of them that has a guy who has a road paving business. But this guy for his road paving business, he has to buy all of the inputs he needs for this road paving business. This guy would like to backwards integrate his business into having the manufacturing that creates the materials he's buying from another company for his business. So Matt is going to take some of the money his real estate business generates and invest it in this guy's company, so that he's going to help build this guy's productive business, and he's going to get a productive asset and ownership, you know, share in this guy's company. And so we're always wanting to take our money and put it into something that is going to heal. This is just very, very biblical. The parable of the talents. So, you know, the story is a master comes. He's getting ready to go away on a trip. He looks at his servants. He says, okay, I'm giving one of you one talent, one of you five talents, one of you 10 talents. The story ends. He eventually comes back. The one guy's like, hey, you gave me 10 talents. I used it productively. I've doubled it. And the master's like, exactly. Dude with 5 talents. Hey, here, I've doubled it for you. Great. Dude with 1 talent. I squandered it. Master ain't happy. So the Bible has this view of, you want to be using the things God has given you to increase them. This has been one of the worst parts of some aspects of modern evangelical culture, is an almost anti-success mentality. Have any of you encountered that? You know, like, if you're a successful Christian, it's a bad thing. I'm like, our desire as churches, the best whatever in your county, you want to be ran by Christians. Another project, Matt Cook, church to his south that their partners with is working on, is one of the men had a plumbing HVAC electrical type company. And they were at County Before Country, and we sat down together and talked. And their goal is to, in that tri-county area, have the best, most successful HVAC plumbing electrical company for that whole county. Because then, you know, they're going to have this huge productive asset that it's a place some of the men the churches are producing can get good jobs. But think about it. Every time people need interacted with, they're going to be calling this truly Christian reformed company. So we want to be investing, especially in other Christians' productive assets. There's so many of these available. It can be a coffee shop. It can be a bookstore. It can be an elderberry business. There's just so many options business-wise. So this raises the question, well, John, because Paul wanted me to know this. Well, what do I know? How can I begin to narrow down the options for business? Because, again, you know, there's like a million businesses you can choose from. So, somebody was asking earlier, like, why do we learn math? This is why we learn math. Because math comes and finds you on occasion. So, good old Venn diagram, if you remember this from high school. Circles. So, the first circle is your skills and interests. There are just some things in life you know you never want to do. True? There are just some things you know that is not for me. And you know that for some of your kids. You know, you look at some of your kids, and like my son Noah, he is going to be an engineering type fellow. When he was 3 years old, he disassembled one of the major appliances in our house. And he's always done that. Like, just anytime I bring home anything, his first desire is to take it apart so he can figure out how it was put together and how it works. So I know that about Noah. Like, he's just wired this way. God wires people with certain skills and interests. And you really don't want to put them into jobs or things that are contrary to that. Because why did God make them that way? So your skills and interests. You know, second is your resources. and opportunities. You know, I had a person come to me, and they're like, John, I want to be a blueberry farmer. I'm like, great, have you ever tested your soil for its acidity and structure? He goes, yeah, he goes, the pH is like 7.5. I'm like, you do know blueberries like acidic for soil. You know, you trying to do things that you don't have the right resources and opportunities for because of your location. You know, it's doing real estate in Tennessee right now. Big opportunity. You're near a growing town. So if you have the money to acquire land and do land development or other things, that's a great opportunity. Doing land development in Montana? Not a whole lot of opportunity. Not very many people moving to Montana. So you, because of where you're located and because of your church community, your current job, and other things, you have particular resources and opportunities that other people don't have. So that's the second circle you want to explore. You know, it just all depends kind of. And then the last one is, what do people want or need? Because it doesn't matter if you enjoy doing something and you have the resources to do it, if people don't actually want to buy it or need it. So I see this all the time with people where, do you know what's the easiest thing to sell to somebody? Something they already buy. This is counterintuitive. I was at a homesteading conference about 5 years ago. Do you know how many books have been written on raising chickens? There's an innumerable number of books on raising chickens. It's crazy. Or take sourdough. Do you know how many books there are on sourdough? Bread baking? Easily 1,000 books on sourdough bread baking. Probably written in the last 2 decades. Now, a lot of us, when we see that, we say to ourselves, what? Well, clearly there's no more need for more books on sourdough baking. You're wrong. Absolutely wrong. Like, my wife and I wrote a book on sourdough baking. It's already sold like 5,000 or 6,000 copies. It's ridiculous. It's very easy to sell people things that they already buy. It's very hard to convince people to buy something new. If somebody is already buying something, kind of like my breakfast sausage example from yesterday, they already buy this. You're already halfway there. They're already used to spending money on it. Now you just need to get them to spend their money with you. So figuring out your market opportunity is crucial. Because when you match all three of these, that's the sweet spot where you have a much easier to build business opportunity. So I'm always looking, you know, so in our house, when our children reach 10 years of age, they're required to start a business. So when you reach 10 years of age in our house, you must build a business. Your free lunch ticket no longer gets stamped at the cafeteria counter. And you must begin to do something that lets you generate money. And I help each of the kids with this. And I walk them through, well, what things are you interested in? What things are a good fit for our farm and our family at this stage of life? And then what are things people will actually buy? You know, because you might be interested in giant Mangalese bunny rabbits for whatever reason. But if nobody wants to buy giant Mangalese bunny rabbits, it doesn't matter if it's a great fit for your land and interest of yours, because you can't build a business around that. So, so my daughter's first business when she was 10 years old was doing pullet chickens. Everybody know what a pullet chicken is? Basically, it's a chicken that's about 14 to 18 weeks old. It'll be laying in the not-too-distant future. Because it's a pain in the butt to buy baby chickens and to raise them all the way out to laying for a small backyard flock. Because the cost of buying 10 chickens is really, really high. The cost of buying 100 chickens, much, much lower. So you have this economy of scale opportunity. So she would buy 200 baby chickens, and she would raise them until they were 14 to 16 weeks old, and then we would sell them to all of the yuckleheads up in Louisville who keep like 5-6 chickens in their backyard. And she made really, really good money doing that as a 10-year-old. My son Caleb, his first business was doing worm compost. So people, if you find the right people, they love to buy worm compost. So he sells, they're around $3,000 to $3,500 a year of worm compost to people around. You're like, he sells worm poop for profit. Yes, it's true. Like, he sells a lot of worm poop for profit. We had already been doing worm composting when I was still in seminary and starting to get into all of this craziness. In my wife and I's first apartment building, I was guerrilla worm composting in the basement of the apartment building. Things my landlord did not know. We also had our first child in the apartment because we did a home birth. Other things our landlord hopefully still does not know. Don't know if that was in the lease agreement. So my son does worm compost. He also sells cherry tomatoes to a chain of 4 stores up in Louisville. Because we already have to go to Louisville once a week for me to run buying club. Cherry tomatoes are a better margin product. And this is one of the reasons I do this with my kids, because I want them to learn to look and see opportunity. You know, where are there products or opportunities to make $15, $20, $25, $30 an hour? So he does cherry tomatoes for this set of stores and sells them a couple thousand dollars of cherry tomatoes in a given year. He's kind of starting to outgrow that business, so he might pass it on to his younger brother. So for a number of years, we had our elderberry syrup business. My daughter, she began to get tired of doing the pullet chickens. And our farm has a ridiculous amount of predator pressure. And so it was getting harder and harder to maintain these flocks and stuff. And it was eating into the profit margin. We had a friend who'd been doing elderberry syrup for the buying club, and she wanted to stop, and I said to Abby, I go, hey, if you want to be done doing these chickens, would you want to make elderberry syrup for the buying club and for its members? And so she started making elderberry syrup for the buying club, you know, selling 10 or so bottles a week of elderberry syrup, making it at home, going rogue, just kind of doing this. And I went to a conference that fall. I was like, I'm going to give a talk on elderberry. And I decided to give a talk on elderberry, and it was standing room only. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. I'm just like, all these people really want to learn about this plant. And that's what let me know that this is something people wanted. You really, you know, Paul, since you're at the farmer's market, I talked about this some last night, you want to become a keen observer of people and what they're really doing, truly doing with their money and with their time. Because that's what points to opportunity. So I went home after that weekend and I said, I'm going to write a book about elderberry. Because I was like, standing room only. If people are willing to come to a talk about elderberry, they're clearly, I had people at that talk, had I already written the book, I would have sold 100 copies that day. Every single person would have bought a copy of a book about elderberry. I was like, I'm going to write a book about elderberry. But we took some of our money and we invested in building the elderberry business. Because, you know, it was a good fit for us at the time. We had interest and skills and there was clearly a market opportunity. And our elderberry business went from $4,000 to $140,000 in 3 years. So some of these things can scale very, very quickly if you find the right opportunity and you develop some good marketing skills. So any question about these three circles, this aspect of how we do household economy as a family, or anything you'd want to?
Yeah, the one thing that occurs to me is that there's a sort of a smorgasbord approach to business that's out there. It's a, you know, when I started my first business, you know, I went to the SBA, Small Business Administration. Of course, what they want to do is bury you in debt and lend money to you so you'll fail. You know, that's the basic idea of that. But still it is, you know, what kind of a business is out there? Let's identify, you know, my experience is a little different. All the business opportunities that I'm dealing with, and there's a half a dozen of them on my palette, you know, things that could be spun into businesses, but they all grow from me serving my own needs. You know, so when we were with a young family homeschooling, I said to my wife, you know, you need to learn to bake bread. Well, it's, you know, we've got a bakery business now out of that thing, and we've never borrowed a dime. Build out all the infrastructure. We're still building infrastructure related to it. But I could talk to you about fixing my own automobiles and the business opportunities that are there, or selling automobile parts, you know, on eBay and things like that. I've shipped parts all over the world. You know, I think four countries now, as well as the United States, Oldsmobile diesel, six-cylinder Oldsmobile diesel parts I've shipped all over the world. Now, that could have been some, you know, it's not that level of interest, maybe, but nevertheless, you know, it can be, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and so these are the point is, it's not just, if we take an approach to business this way, it's, many of the smorgasbord type approaches to business, you have to develop the skill in advance anyway. And if we're serving ourselves by raising our own food and eating that food, raising our own cattle, learning to butcher and doing various things like that, the things that we begin to do well to serve ourselves open up the opportunity that we didn't normally have or didn't have before.
Yeah.
It's that kind of a family life, working together as a family, as opposed to, let me just survey the landscape. Oh, I think I'd like to print T-shirts and have a business selling T-shirts, you know, or, you know, you name it.
Yeah. And, you know, so for us, all of our businesses came out of building a productive household. So a couple other examples. We call him the Discount Irvington Jesus, because there's a guy in our city of Irvington, and he has long hair. And he basically always is wearing like robes that look straight out of the first century. And he shows up at our post office one or two days a week. And he walks up and he's always wearing flip-flop sandal type things. And he walks up with two big boxes, packages to ship. And he just sets them down and he leaves. I tried to find out who this guy was. So it was basically a kid who his dad was a computer type person. And so growing up, he was constantly working on and fixing computers. So he was having to buy parts to work on and fix computers with his dad. And he got tired of the low quality parts he was dealing with. So by the time he was in late high school, he started his own computer part business. And so by the time I first saw him, he was like 19 or 20 years old. And the best I gathered is he was making $4,000 a week. And that's net. So like $10,000 a week in sales. This is a 20-year-old kid making $4,000 a week selling computer parts on eBay. And it was an outgrowth of his family. So Jason Mateus, they are a homesteading family in Virginia who I'm friends with. And he sent me a link for you all. So any of you who need to buy garden seeds, Jason, they're a Reformed Presbyterian family. And I'll write the link here so you can write it down. But they're a Reformed Presbyterian homesteading family. I believe they have 8 or 9 kids. In South, southeastern-ish Virginia. They're homesteading, they're raising food, they're growing food, and they started doing a lot of seed preservation. It's like, oh, it's pretty, pretty cool. Do you know how much seeds cost per ounce to buy? They're the same price roughly as silver, if you've never thought about this. When you buy garden seeds, most garden seeds are the same price per ounce as silver. Yeah, that's a pretty crazy thing to think about, That's what each little package is like, parting with, some silver. So Jason's like, we're already doing seed saving, and some of the other families in his community were doing seed saving. Do you know how big America's garden seed market is per year? It's easily probably a $500 million to billion-dollar market. How much money people spend on seeds and stuff each year in America. So Jason goes, we should have a family seed business. So he started a company called Seeds for Generations. And I believe they are on track. Next year, they will probably break $500,000 in sales. And in another 18 to 24 months after that, they might break $1 million in sales. Because 10 years ago, him and his kids started to learn how to save and preserve their own seeds. And the beauty is, though, what Jason and them have done is, they have their own household family business. But he now employs or buys from or supports roughly a dozen other households and families. Because they can't raise all of these things themselves for seeds. So he has contracts with other Christian families to raise a bunch of the seeds for them. Because we want to do good to all people, especially the household of faith. And what better thing to do than financially support other like-minded households? Why give your money to people who hate you? One thing I've never understood about Christians is like the Bible teaches we're at war. And there's the enemies of God. And I'm like, yes, and I give all of my discretionary spending to them. The only people in history who have ever supported their enemies in war are the U.S. government. Let that sink in. So nobody else has ever done this for the most part. Like only our geopolitical geniuses think that it's prudent to actively monetarily fund our enemies. I always talk with Christians. I'm like, because Christians are like, John, why don't you want to shop at grocery stores? Why don't you want to have to buy your things from Amazon or here or there? Like, because they hate me, and they hate my God, and they hate my children. So why would I want to give them the resources to destroy me? So Jason carries my books in his online store, because I'd much rather somebody buy one of my books from Jason than from Amazon. So the beauty is, as we build these businesses, there's all these opportunities to support, help, and lock arms with each other as we do these things. So his is a great example of a business that came out of him wanting to have a productive household, and him also wanting to be able to transition back to working with his kids rather than working for his kids, if that distinction makes sense. Because that's really what most modern work is for most men. They are working for their wife and kids instead of working with their wife and kids. And while not all of us are going to be able to get back to a point of working with our wife and kids, we want to set up a lot of our children to be able to work with their wife and kids. Anything else you want to ask or add? Because there's so many opportunities. Again, like my son Noah. We had an electric range go bad a number of months ago. And through Providence, somebody in our church had the exact same electric range that also was damaged. And they put in a gas range because they had just moved to a, house with gas rather than electric. So they were getting rid of it. Me and my son Noah, one thing I always do with him, because he's very mechanically inclined, is anytime I'm doing wiring around the house, anytime I'm doing appliance repair, I especially make sure Noah does it with me. And in a few more years, if he continues to show interest and aptitude, then maybe we start to advertise locally. And a great way to do this is kind of like the business you were talking about. A lot of people don't want to mess with repairing appliances. And it's pretty expensive to repair appliances. But what's really cheap is to cannibalize appliances. My friend's stove, its handle and a few other things were bad. My stove, most likely the thermostat or one of the controllers had gone out. It's a match made in parts heaven. So Noah and I cannibalized parts from the one stove to fix the other stove. And then all we have is our time. And now we still have all of the other good working parts on that other stove to continue to fix our stove moving forward. So I'm like, man, I just need to make a bay or two in the barn for Noah and just advertise locally on Facebook groups and other things. Like, hey, you have a dishwasher, you have a dryer, you have a this or that that's no longer working. Just let us know. We'll come by and grab it next time we're in the area. And then Noah continues to build on these skills he's already been developing that also save our house money and make our house more productive and might become a good little business for him moving forward, and just see where that goes.
Yeah, so I was asking you about this before. Maybe you comment on it, but it seems to me, this has been my thinking over the years, there's a high carrying cost to deal in cash. It's almost like going to the fair. You take your family to the fair, the county fair, and kids are going to go on the rides. They don't let you spend money to go on the rides. You have to buy tickets in advance. And so, by the time you're out there given four tickets for a kid to go on a ride, you don't really recognize the cost of going on the ride anymore. the ticket, you bought 20 tickets for $10 or something like that. Four tickets for the ride. You don't say $2. You know, it's this kind of a thing. So, see, cash is that as well. And you don't really see the carrying cost to spend $150 for a service call on the appliance to get the guy out there. You know, and that's just the beginning because he's going to have to buy the parts. So you've got a $400 charge, you know, when you're all done to have this appliance repaired, to have the timer put on it or whatever. But really, it is not $400 because you got a tax rate. You've got sale, there's sales tax on the service thing, you know, it's probably double, you know. So for my personal interest, it's always been that I'd rather spend, you know, if it's $600, you know, what is my labor rate? You know, at $30 an hour, I can spend $20 and do something or 20 hours and do something for myself. And see, and not be in the cash-based economy. So that's been my attitude. Maybe you have something to say about that or comment on.
So, you know, one thing I always encourage people, guy I went to when I was in seminary, group of us were at the cafeteria. And so a bunch of us students are eating at the cafeteria together. And Jeremy Redden was his name. One of the other, so we're all sitting there, and Jeremy was one, I think only him and I had brought our own food to the cafeteria to eat. And Jeremy pulls out his little, you know, lunch sack thing to begin to eat. And one of the other students looks at Jeremy and he goes, "Why do you never eat? Why do you never buy food from the cafeteria?" And Jeremy goes, he goes, "How much did your lunch today cost you?" And the guy goes, "Well, it cost me $8. And Jeremy goes, "No, you're wrong." He goes, "It cost you 1 hour of your life. Because it takes you 1 hour to earn those $8. And that really stuck with me. So because especially men in Christian circles like ours, to acquire money, we spend our very lives. That is how this modern economy works. And so you want to learn to be wise with money, because money in a very real sense represents one thing you can never get back, which is your time. So being wanton with your money is basically the equivalent of saying you don't care about your life itself. Because every dollar you spend, you had to spend a certain number of hours, minutes, or days acquiring. And so it really teaches us prudence. You know, then the other thing in our economy, I used this example a few months ago somewhere. Imagine you want to buy something that costs $20,000 from me. How much does that actually cost you? Generally speaking, if you're a moderately well-earning family in America, if you want to buy something that costs $20,000, you had to earn $27,000 to $30,000. So to have $20,000 to spend, you have to earn up to sometimes 50% more. Now, because a lot of you have a lot of kids, this is a tighter spread, hopefully. And then on my side, depending on what I'm selling you, I'm going to lose up to $7,000 of this. Do you see what a scam this is? That on a $20,000 transaction, the government can pocket up to $10,000 here and up to $7,000 there? man, that irks me. One thing I strongly encourage Christians is this is why having a non-monetary economy among your church folks and community is infinitely valuable. Because the only way dollars can exchange hands is if somebody gets their greedy little paws all over it at every single time the money is exchanged. So the dollar-denominated economy with the current progressive, aggressive tax system is designed to constantly impoverish you and yours along the way. This is also why the government despises people not being considered employees. So have you ever noticed the government's war on trying to make everybody be classified as an employee? Do you know why they want everybody as an employee? Exactly. When you are an employee, do you know what you can deduct?
Nothing.
Absolutely. You drive to work? Don't care. You drive 2 hours to work? So sorry. You get no mileage deduction, no kind of rebate for that. You have to buy clothes for work? Don't matter. We don't care. You use your cell phone for work? Does not matter. We don't care. Nothing. When you are an employee, you get absolutely no benefit. Because how many of you have heard that, like, Amazon pays no taxes? And, Bezos, like, all of these people don't pay any taxes. And you're like, that's so unfair. Well, fairness or not aside, if you're self-employed or have your own business, you won't have to pay taxes either if you are smart. So this is, the medical kits we have. We have a homestead. We have a homestead-based business. And the government has a page on the Small Business Administration website called ready.gov, where they tell business owners, you should have basic preparedness as part of your business for natural disasters and other stuff. This is like the greatest blank check you could ever imagine. Firearms, ammo, lights, generators, medical kits, medical supplies, medical training.
Deductibles?
It's all deductible. Every single last bit of it. I never drive. So we train as a family judo and jujitsu. I deduct it all. Because when we do a conference like Homesteaders of America, do you know what we have to handle a lot of? Cash. After a weekend at Homesteaders of America, we might have $4,000 of cash on our persons. Does that make us likely to be targeted for victimization? Absolutely. Being known as a cash-based business means you are more likely to have somebody try and rob you. So as a small business, it would make sense to give me and my employees, my children, skills necessary to defend themselves. I can say that with a straight face if I get audited.
That's right.
I don't drive unless it's a tax deduction. I think last year my mileage deduction was $14,000. Again, we have our own business. How many of you want to get away just with your wife on occasion? But hey, like, you're a household economy, a household business. She's the other major stakeholder. So my wife and I are probably going to be going to a friend's cabin in late November or sometime in December for a couple day getaway. But part of that trip, we're going to talk about, do we want to do this Tennessee land deal? I'm going to deduct the entire cost of the trip.
business meals are 100% deductible now.
Yeah. So, but here's the real kicker for Christian businesses. The greatest tax deduction you may have never heard about. So if you have a family-based business and your kids work in that business, you can pay them $12,400 per child per year if they are actually working in that business. And it is completely taxed free. No FICA, no Social Security, no anything. So our elderberry business last year, our kind of farm elderberry business, brought in, I don't know, like probably around $70,000 net. So my eldest daughter was paid $12,400, and my oldest son was paid $12,400, and Noah was paid $12,400, and Ellie was paid like $6,000, and Lily, who's only 5, I paid like $4,000.
Now you gotta buy your own clothes.
Actually, that's what we do. So our kids are responsible to pay for a bunch of their stuff. Joel, how many of you have heard of Joel Salatin? He tells a hilarious story about him and his brother when they were like 10 or 11 years old. Joel's dad was an accountant. And Joel and his brother are upstairs in their bedroom. And his dad walks up into the bedroom and he hands Joel a check. This is like, you know, December 10th or something. And Joel rolls open this check and the check says like $4,000. And Joel is ecstatic. Joel's just like, I cracked into the biggest smile you ever did see. And I'm just like, wow, Dad. And Dad goes, I don't know what you're smiling for. He goes, throw that out the window. He goes, I just have to make sure I've paid you. So, and that's what his dad would do. He would pay his sons for their work on the farm to offset all the farm income. You know, because, you know, that this story is probably from like 1970-something. Back when $4,000 was really something to shake a stick at. You know, so as much as we can keep money out of the taxable economy, you know, I highly, and this is why we want to build households and churches with diverse skill sets. You know, because like, I'm good at raising food, I'm good at self-defense and firearms and stuff, I can help you with that, but you might be good at repairing cars. You know, like, I can do basic car repair, you know, I can like, change oil, I can change brakes, I can do some other things on a car, but really starting to tear it apart, car apart, I'm not a gearhead like that. I'm just not wired that. But one of you might be. If we charge each other to help each other, we both become poorer. If we merely serve each other, and if they ever say, well, like, why aren't you reporting this as income? Because we're a church. I'm not doing this as a business thing. This is just what the Bible commands me to do, and my religion protects me. And we serve one another, you take a whole bunch of resources out of the hands of a problematic entity, to say the least, and we begin to become more wealthy, more asset rich as believers this way. But the tax code, especially if you're building these family-based businesses, there is no reason you should ever be paying taxes. Because if you ever get a business that's so big, you outgrow some of these strategies, I have other people I can tell you about. So there's a guy who's a friend of Jason Mateus, and he specializes in putting businesses into a trust where the business can grow and not be taxed. Just all kinds of, you know, this is how the rich get richer. And employed people have a hard time building capital because they have access to things You don't as an employee. But a lot of you, you know, if you have six kids is a lot of runway for business profit. And so for my kids, they pay for a lot of their stuff. But each of them are developing an asset war chest. So my son Caleb, he's only 15 years old, and he thinks he has $5,000. I don't tell my kids this, but I can say this since they're not here. But I have matching roughly the same amount of assets as what they've saved in a separate place for them to reward their hard work and stuff later. You know, so he has easily 10 grand or more in, because he also owns some silver and also owns a couple other investment type things with me and a few friends. So my hunch is my son, by the time he hits 18 years old, he might have $50,000 in assets and resources at his disposal. And he's not going to college. He is going to immediately maybe start a real estate type venture or something, because that's how he's wired. He's, you know, he's highly dyslexic and he's not a big fan of school, but he's more than willing to work. And so, well, what would be good for him, man? Him having his own real estate thing where he manages a bunch of rental properties and he renovates stuff and we go buy a property at the, the step sale at the courthouse step sale in Kentucky or wherever we are. Like, that would be a great fit for him. He can listen to podcasts all day long because reading isn't his strong point because he's strongly dyslexic, but he's a bright kid. He can listen to podcasts, listen to sermons, and renovate a house and triple his money every 5-6 years of doing this and support and build a family this way. So, other thoughts just on practical strategy.
So, how in the household economy do you manage the economy scale in terms of, especially like you were talking about the other very business, where just all of a sudden hit right like that? How do you keep that growth curve where it doesn't balloon out for the family and the household in general? It becomes too consuming.
You just have to decide for yourself. So when we had, you know, we had a 3-month period where we had $60,000 in elderberry sales. And Jess and I were just in agreement, we'll make up school time this summer. I mean, you know, you make hay while the sun shines. So for us, it was us working with our kids. So we would go to the certified kitchen. I'm like, you know, where are we at in Ambleside? Oh, we're supposed to be listening to Virgil's Aeneid. Well, let's throw Virgil's Aeneid up on the computer. We'll bring the sound bar from the house, and we will all listen. And as we make elderberry, we will discuss Virgil's Aeneid as we listen. So my wife and I are flexible enough where if we need to postpone certain parts of school, or if we need to revamp what that part of school looks like for a season, because God has given us an opportunity to acquire a bunch of resources, that's what we did. That may or may not be a great fit for your family and your personalities. So I can thrive on that level of disruption. Some other people can't thrive on that level of disruption. So, you know, you would have to cross that bridge when you hit it. But to me, I'm just like, you know, for elderberry for our family, you know, we could make 200 bottles of elderberry in about 6 hours at the kitchen. That's $5,000 of elderberry in 6 hours at the kitchen. Then we'd have another 6 hours shipping and packing. So that's 12 hours of work. That's $425 an hour, $416 an hour somewhere. I'm just like, I can postpone quite a bit of stuff for $416 an hour. So, you know, like, it's hot in Kentucky in July anyway. The kids will gladly do some of their school in July and August when it's miserable to be outside. And let's knock out this opportunity that God has given us. But again, you have to, if you have that happen to you, you have to sort that with your family. But what some other people do is, you know, this is why you have a church community. We also, you know, that was just too much work for our family to do. But we brought in a bunch of other good people from other families we knew. Some of whom, because this was during Rona, their families really needed some extra work. Because they were forced out of working because of the stupidity. So we also used it as an opportunity to help a bunch of families in our community who had people who should have been working but weren't able.